Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now I'll call in for those of you who have been in touch with anyone in India during the massive blackout of the last few days. Call us with the stories that you are hearing from friends or family or colleagues there. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In American terms, you know, this is almost inconceivable in terms of scale. 600 million people losing power, which would be double the entire population of the United States. It's half the population of India. Tell us what you're hearing about it firsthand. 212-433-WNYC. Amazingly, they did get power restored in the last day, apparently, which is quite a feat in and of itself, considering how widespread the failure was and how many people were affected. Don't they go door to door for like weeks after a storm in New Jersey trying to get all the power back on? But I guess they're all up again in India, amazingly. But who wants to call in and tell us what you're hearing? How hot is it wherever you've had contact with? How did people survive that heat? How are people coping? Who do they blame? And what do they want done? Indian Americans or anyone with contacts there, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Remember we talked last month in our July series on air conditioning about the rapidly increasing demand on power supplies in the global south as India and other developing countries increasingly plug in to air conditioning and other things? Is that part of the issue? 212-433-WNYC. And people are complaining about the state-run monopoly transmission system that doesn't seem to have the capacity to process all the coal the country has ready to burn. Is that what you think the problem is? Is there even a question of the inefficiency of democracy with India as compared with China, which is developing its infrastructure so quickly under an authoritarian regime? So anyone with ties to India, give us a call and tell us what you're hearing or what you're thinking after the biggest blackout in human history. 650 million people is the best estimate who had to go without power for the last couple of days. We'll take your calls after this, 212-433-WNYC. If you've been speaking with anybody affected by the massive blackout in India, 212-433-9692. Your call's coming right up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now a call in for those of you who've been in touch with anyone in India during the massive blackout of the last few days. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Pranati in New Jersey, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling in.
Good morning, Brian. My daughter, who is 29, she has been in India for the last 2 years.
Uh-huh. And you've been speaking to your daughter?
She has spent most of her life in USA. She was schooled in USA, went to college in USA at Johns Hopkins. So she has spent most of her life in USA. But when I called her, she said, oh, mom, my development is generator backed up. And I couldn't go to the work because I couldn't take metro. But I was fine working from home, and life seemed pretty normal for her.
So
I think we in USA get more upset about power outages and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. And power outages, as I understand it, are quite common in India.
Absolutely. And people just have a resilience and a way of adapting to the things. You know, 15 days back, I called her and she said, Mom, right now the temperature is 110 degrees in my apartment.
Pranati, thank you very much. So maybe we just need to chill out a little bit more about our own blackouts when they come. Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good.
I've been living part of the time for the last 11 years in India, and I'm back in New York on the Upper East Side. And the issue of air conditioning is certainly one that I've been dealing with on many levels, and I've been glad that you've been bringing it up. I've been watching more and more people I know in Delhi start turning on their air conditioners in April and then continuing through to October. Of course, each year it depends on when the monsoons have come. This year they actually came on time. What I've been observing in Delhi is a change in pollution in weather in the last 10 years with the increase in construction, laptops, mobile phones, and of course, additions of millions of cars on the roads. So we are facing, of course, major change in the worlds that some of us live in, where electricity and air conditioning have become a daily part of life.
And so do you conclude that this is more demands of modernity than India could bear, or that it's the wrong direction? Or do you conclude that, you know, India needs to join the modern world if it's going to have a modern economy and take hundreds of millions of poor people out of poverty eventually, and the government needs to keep up, and they're not doing a good enough job?
Well, a lot of those points are, of course, very valid, and there are many, many points because everything in India is quite complicated. So just as you start to unravel to have an answer, there are all these other interlocking elements.
Yes.
There's no question that the numbers in terms of sheer population of when you're talking of a burgeoning or of a growing middle class, we are talking about numbers that are so different from our Western concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Secondly, yes, of course, the more that you advertise, the more that you expose people to things, the more they want these things. And, of course, the whole issue, I also had lived in China, and mm-hmm. I've watched the pollution things there, in Beijing especially. So the whole issue of how do you modernize without destroying your ecosystems is obviously saying that most human beings, aside for very small, homogeneous countries, especially Scandinavia, haven't seemed to quite figure out. But this issue of need and want, there's still so many people living on the streets in Delhi. Let's just take, for example, where
yes.
I live. And it's not as if everybody's using air conditioning or air conditioned cars or laptops. However,
yeah.
So many people who don't even have running water have mobile phones now. So I think that I appreciate the stoicism in India. It has definitely strengthened me in terms of dealing with things. But as I was mentioning to your producer when I called in, one of the major issues in looking at a situation like this, since I've had to pay electricity bills and deal with having my electricity sometimes taken by a neighbor and having to deal with the lack of consumer redress with the electricity board in Delhi, is a fine line between stoicism and apathy. To what point people get pushed before they react?
So the previous caller who said, oh, people in the United States get too upset about things like this. In India, we have power blackouts all the time, and we shrug it off and we go on. Is that stoicism or apathy?
Well, I would say that it's definitely strengthened me, as I said, to deal with things. But at a certain point, when you realize that everybody just puts up with things because the bureaucracy or the lack of having a right to sometimes push things, I do think here, though, that it's true. I mean, things fall apart here. I was just speaking this morning after getting oodles of messages from Facebook and emails from India about how many hours yesterday, 15 hours, 7 hours this morning of not having power, of somebody telling me they arrived back in Millbrook the other day, and they arrived back in Brooklyn the other day, the entire street out
right.
on Friday night.
So stuff happens. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your call.
Very
I appreciate
welcome.
It. We're taking calls from anybody who has contacts with India, friends, family, colleagues there. What are you hearing after the blackout of the last 2 days, the biggest blackout in human history affecting more than 600 million people? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And joining us briefly to talk about this is Anand Giridharadas. He is the current columnist for the New York Times and author of the book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Anand, thank you very much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be back here.
What do you think about the couple of conversations we were just having?
I think a lot of interesting issues were raised. I think one of them is this question of the line between stoicism and apathy, and I think that's actually a very foundational issue in India. It is true, as the first caller said, that Indians are resilient, able to work around problems like this, perhaps not on this scale ordinarily, able to cope. But at some point, there is a problem when coping becomes the default activity in a country because the people who are supposed to provide the things that make you not need to cope and work around simply fail to provide them again and again. And it's not just electricity. It's everything from public transportation to adequate airports to good roads, all the commons systems that, that ordinary people use. And one simple statistic that always stunned me was that more people in India have access to a cell phone than to a flush toilet. Which tells you something about the extraordinary gap between the country's ability to provide private infrastructure and inability to provide public infrastructure.
I wonder, too, and I hate to even bring the question up, but whether this indicates that democracies are just less good at economic development than authoritarian governments. If China is criticized for anything about infrastructure, it's too much building of things that the population isn't ready to use yet. Whereas India, one of the world's oldest democracies by now, struggles to get things built and doesn't have the transmission capacity for all the coal that I've read is ready to go and prevent blackouts like this, or at least as many or as big, as the country tries to modernize its economy. How much of a legitimate topic of discussion do you think that is?
I think it's an extremely legitimate topic, and I actually always chafe when people think it's something that shouldn't even be discussed. But I think in this case, the problem is you're asking a question about a deeply flawed democracy. So it's unclear whether the outcomes, the negative outcomes, are because democracy is bad or because it's being operated here in an extremely flawed way, as it is in this country. I mean, in the U.S., you have, you know, people voting and choosing their government, and then a very small percentage of them are happy with their government. So this happens everywhere. But I think in India, the gap between people's interests and what ends up coming down the pipeline in policy is enormous. So that raises a question about not so much does democracy work, but is this actually democracy?
That's interesting. And it even relates to the previous conversation we were having about Mitt Romney in the Middle East. If he's going to compare Israeli and Palestinian culture and their relationship to prosperity, well, what about Singapore, which, you know, a lot of free marketers in this country use as a model that the United States should follow more. And that's not exactly a model of freedom.
You know, to that point, the earlier discussion is very interesting. And I think, although I don't normally channel Mitt Romney, the point about culture actually is, in this case, in the case of the blackout, something worth thinking about, because it has to do with political culture. The narrow explanation for this is the power grids aren't adequate up to the task. The deeper explanation is that wealthy and powerful people in India are more or less insulated from the deficiencies of public space. They don't drive, they don't walk on the roads, and they don't drive on them, they are driven in them. They don't use the public schools. They don't really use the police because they hire their own security guards. They don't drink the water from the tap because they drink bottled water or Evian flown in from overseas. And they self-generate their own electricity in many cases, in big companies, but also in private homes. So when the people with the power to improve public space don't use public space, the appetite to improve it is minimal. And to some degree, that is a cultural issue. The elite in India have historically always been removed from the very existences of ordinary people.
Anand Giridharadas, author of India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking, as we take your calls on your contacts with people in India over the last few days during history's largest power blackout. Anand, do you want to hang around for a few minutes and take
sure.
some calls with me? Dharmveer in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hello, Ryan. How are you?
Good, thank you. Have you been calling home?
Yes, I have my all folks in Delhi, and some of them, they live in neighboring state also. It's horrible that what we hear, they don't have any power, they don't have any water. And it reflects the culture of corruption in India, that what exactly is happening at central level, we call federal as a central government, and what's happening at the state level. They do not understand what is the a problem there. They just wanted to please their bosses. They wanted to please the federal ministers. They also know that there's a heavy demand, but whenever it comes to setting up a new power plant or anything, it's amazing that a dog can sit in the street and he can start a hunger strike and he can say that, I don't want this dam, I don't want this power plant to be set up here. So how come India can become a superpower? How come India can meet its needs and the power requirements?
They do they do the same thing in New York. Maybe it's not hunger strikes, but it's other forms of political action. Nobody wants power plants or anything else in their backyard. But Anna, give us your take on the Indian context of that kind of opposition.
You know, the caller is exactly right, which is you have enormous and growing demand, but the demand is you have to separate private demand for the demand for kind of public goods like electricity. So what happens is people have enormous private appetites, and that's great. People want jeans, they want malls, they want phones, they want cars, they want refrigerators. They want the way of life people have been living in rich countries for a long time. What is I think scarcely understood is that each of those things I mentioned, from the jeans to the malls to the phone, make certain demands on public goods. You can't make the jeans without certain kinds of factories, certain kinds of roads, certain kinds of electricity. You can't make the phones work without towers and therefore public land that you have to secure to put the towers on. All of those public goods have been enormously difficult to create because the government has struggled to acquire the land from villagers in a way that's humane to the villagers. Politicians have taken any opportunity to create factory land or other kinds of land as a re-election platform, so they go and they hold hunger strikes and other kinds of violent things to prevent big companies from doing this. So there's a mismatch between the country's desire for these private goods and unwillingness at many levels to produce the public goods that allow those private goods to be created.
Well, let's get one more caller in here before we run out of time. Harris in Oakland Gardens. Hi, Harris.
Hi. This is Harish. I was listening to the radio as I was driving back from a religious festival in temple. So just I wanted to say, like other lady mentioned about this has been the way of life in India for many years. Especially we used to have a planned power shutdown every day, like 7 to 8 in the morning, 10 to 12 in the afternoon, like that. So the only point I want to emphasize is India has to definitely improve on their infrastructure.
What? It definitely needs to grow its infrastructure?
Yeah. And yesterday I was listening to the same topic in WNYC, and the BBC correspondent was on call with the minister in India about the situation. And he was asking about the apology to the public. And he said, no way the apology will be provided.
Why
not? It can't be provided. And moreover, he was mentioning that, oh, North America lost power for 4 days, and people from one of the chief from India was sent to take the situation under control. That's a very, very remote chances going for 4 days here, and that's not because of the infrastructure issue. That's because of something like rain or storm. This is something like really unusual and putting people in a lot of difficulties.
That's an important distinction, that when we have a power outage, it's from rain or a storm. India frequently has them without weather events causing physical damage to
That's
the
exactly.
power. Not that we couldn't be better prepared for that also as a matter of infrastructure. But, Harris, I see that you're from southern
yeah.
India, which actually did not get hit by this power outage.
But there we have a planned outage. Even the demand and supply is managed in such a way that they distribute the power by imposing the power cut every day in all part of the southern India, like especially in the state of Tamil Nadu. We have like 4 to 6 hours every day, and in a planned manner and in a phased manner, city to city to city like that.
Harris, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Ananda, thank you. Ananda, you want to give me a last thought, maybe a reaction to Harris, or whether you think that this incident is a wake-up call for India as it tries to modernize both as an economic power and as a democracy?
I think I hope it's a wake-up call. And this is, you have to understand, part of something larger that's been brewing over the last couple of years, which is this large anti-corruption movement led by Anna Hazare, and now this. I think what it all has in common is, in my hope, the birth of a third phase in India's development. I think the first several decades after independence in 1947 were focused on actually creating public goods, building the nation, and kind of socialist theories. It was then a total flip in the early 90s to radical kind of market philosophy and hoping that markets could solve every problem and believing every word of the world is flat. And I think part of what we're seeing now is a return to saying, you know what, we need to keep the market because it served us well in many ways. It's pulled people out of poverty. It's created wealth. But we now need to go back to some of the public-spiritedness and nation-building and institution-building that was the emphasis right after independence, and maybe do a bit more of a hybrid model of development.
Anand Giridharadas, he is the author of India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Pleasure to be on with you.
And thanks to all of you who called and told us your stories of speaking to folks back in India over the last few days. By the way, speaking of infrastructure and corruption, our Bob Henley will be coming up right after this break on his investigation of corruption and cheating the taxpayer in the New York City construction industry. Stay with us.